got a lot tied up inside. Got Jesus on your mind. And a boy that just won't fight. Baby, it's a grind. And this your bitter light. Where nothing just won't do. The girl pleads. The woman needs a wedding ring. That bird won't sing.
Hey everybody, this is Diane.
And hey, it's Todd in Los Angeles.
And you're here for the long-awaited Heroin Not Just for Hillbillies Anymore episode of...
This Conversation Rocks. By the way, this is going to be episode 20 for the year.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing better than one every other week.
That's good. Well, we've recorded three this week, so, right?
Yeah, it'd be nice if we can kind of, like, put things out on a regular basis, but...
Well, you know, we're doing the best we can.
Yeah, maybe we can get to the point where we're recording two during your off week.
That would be good. And then we've got one that we can release during my that on would, week.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so before we get started, we're going to kind of flashback.
Yeah, we've got a couple of updates,
last year's stuff.
So, I was just telling Todd that I saw a headline yesterday, and I can't honestly say where I saw the headline, probably Huffington Post. I want to say 145 school children were denied entry into, I'm going to say San Diego schools, because their immunizations were not up to date. And as someone who thinks that immunizations are not optional and should not be optional, I'm really glad to see that. And I probably just made a bunch of people's hair catch on fire by saying that.
Well,
I guess, okay, they can be optional, but you can't expect us to put your unimmunized kids in school with our immunized kids. I don't know, that doesn't even sound fair, but...
That's always been the problem, right? Is that it seems like, well, that's not the... That response seems unfair, but the truth of the matter is, it's not fairness. That's a correct response.
It's prevention.
It is a protective response.
Yeah.
To say that if you choose to not immunize your kids for whatever reason, but if you think it's because it causes autism, I would really beg you to go back and check the literature one more time.
Just one more time.
As Google will say, I've got 10,000 reports that say there's no link and one that does.
By the way, Jill Stein, my understanding is that she's kind of pushing the whole, well, vaccines can potentially cause autism, so I really don't know. So Green Party this year, not top of my list.
Yeah, you're done. In fact, we're absolutely done. There's no bottom of the list for this.
Yeah. You know, and
you don't become an option, right? You know, because if you want me to consider going with an alternative to the Republicans and the Democrats,
you
which
have
of course,
to understand science.
Yeah, you cannot be as ignorant as the Republican Party is.
Which you know. Will, I've got that in my fuck that guy this week, because I didn't want to get too belabored by politics, but yeah, there's a lot to talk about this week.
All right, so, but anyway, so California, though, yeah, we did mandate vaccinations
and
for entry into the public schools, and it's something I completely agree with, because it is a herd protection system.
Right, you need the bulk of the herd to be immunized.
So that the people who cannot be, not won't be, but just
there
cannot
you go.
Be, can be protected.
And, you know, I've got to tell you, my policy as a healthcare provider was to never turn it into a fight, but it was always to disagree politely and give as much information as I could. You know, if you turn it into a fight, you lose people. at least in healthcare. But I can politely say I completely disagree with you, and here's some information that you really need to look at. So,
but, and I'm looking at the news right now, though. I mean, this is not a done deal even in San Diego, because we do have a challenge.
Of course.
In court, and the judge held off ruling on the injunction.
So those kids are in school, then?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it's, let's see, there's about 21,000 children that'll be affected by this, by the law, and, federal judge said, oh, he'll make a decision in a couple weeks. Federal judge is trying to punt.
Sure. And this will probably be something that goes to the Supreme Court, but let's hope we have a majority stacked by the Democrats.
Although, honestly,
I don't know that that's going to serve us at all. We need a majority stacked by people who believe in science.
Yeah,
and what does Neil deGrasse Tyson say? He says, science works whether you believe in it or not. So
that's right. That's right. But, you know, I mean, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say one more thing. Again, this goes back to kids who are not immunized because of their parents' choice, not kids who aren't immunized because of other conditions, because of vaccine reactions, which are rare, but they do happen. You know, we're not talking about those kids. Those are the kids we need to protect so that with everybody else being immunized.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, if there's a medical reason why you can't be immunized, we get it.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And then that is where, but we're relying on the fact that we get 93% or better in the rest of the herd to protect those who cannot be, like we were just saying.
Exactly.
So, yeah, this is not over by a long shot, I guarantee you.
It's not, but it's progress, kind of.
Yeah, what we really need is, like, you know, you got to show your shot record before you can get into Disneyland.
Yeah, there you go. or on a cruise ship, or...
Oh, my God, right? I mean, it's my wife and I took a cruise last year, and she hates it, so we won't do it again, and that's fine. I'm relatively on cruises, you know, having done them a couple times. You can have fun, but it's really just drinking cheap booze the entire time, and that's not entirely a lot of fun.
If it were expensive booze, it might be a little different.
Right, yeah, expensive booze at a cheap price, that'd be awesome. But the thing with the cruise ships is just, it's amazing how bad a petri dish those things really are.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it feels like, and this is just feels like that it's not a matter of if you're going to get sick if you go cruising, just when.
Yeah, when is your number up? Well, you know, and even avoiding a little bit the politics of tourism, I would just rather do my own thing. I don't want to be herded from port to port to port.
Oh, sure. So. And, you know, but, you know, for people, you know, like, for people who really dig cruising, I get why they dig it. You know, you don't have to think about it. You know, you've got all the amenities of being home while, you know, in a third world country.
Right.
I mean, you know, and let's be honest, there is something to be said for that. You know, and cheap booze. So, I mean, I get it. It's just, you know, not everybody's thing.
Yeah. Well,
but, you know, Alaska, I mean, okay. You guys wouldn't survive without them, though.
There's some real truth in that. Yeah.
Especially Fairbanks, right?
Well, Fairbanks is part of the inland circuit. I mean, you know that. So there's the whole cruise industry, and then a lot of people, for our non-Alaskan listeners, and there are a few. People get hooked into kind of the inland tours as well. So generally speaking, people will either start with an inland tour, usually involving the Alaska Railroad and tour buses. And then they will get on a cruise, and that'll be the last leg of their vacation. Or they'll do it in reverse. They'll cruise up, and then they'll do the inland tour, and then they'll fly home. So, yeah, I mean, places like Fairbanks, Seward in the summer,
yeah.
Whittier in the summer, those are places that benefit from Juneau, our capital.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, and my point was really more along the lines of, you know, like Fairbanks, freaking genius, right? You know, to have cashed in on the cruise,
right.
The cruise industry to get you, what, 2,000 miles inland?
I don't know how.
Whatever it is.
Well,
800 miles, it's a ways.
That's probably more fair. So I would say from Anchorage to Fairbanks, it's probably about 400 miles.
Yeah.
Just off the top of my head.
Yep.
So, yeah. And there's no port in Anchorage for cruise ships, although it is a port. But yeah, we're way off topic now, aren't we?
Yeah, but hey, here's the good news. I'm going to be coming your way next year.
Really?
We think that we're going to be coming up for taking Lynn's parents.
Excellent.
I can say that because they don't listen to the podcast.
No, really? I thought they'd be our number
surprise.
One.
Surprise! So sorry, we are off topic and you can edit or not, but I think we're going to be able to get up there next year.
Very good. Need a place to stay?
No, we'll be doing the inland tour.
You'll be traveling. Very good. So we'll just have to make a point to meet you at one of the stops.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll spend... I'm going to get some time in and around Anchorage.
Very good.
So that we can make that happen.
Excellent. Well, now all of our listenership has your itinerary next year, too.
Hey, everybody, come to Alaska.
Need a place to stay?
All right.
Okay, so we really said that we were going to not get overly political, although, again, all politics are local, right?
Because... Yeah, absolutely. And the vaccination thing is an ongoing political situation because of our refusal to believe in science.
Well, and how do you talk about heroin addiction and addiction in general without being political?
Or talking about science.
Right. So
let's talk about what we think most people think of when we talk about heroin.
Well, absolutely. I think people still think of the Skid Row junkie, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, totally. And I think there are still a lot of stereotypes about the Black community and heroin use, which are actually completely turned upside down by what we know about this quote-unquote new heroin epidemic. So I think what people think is very different from what the new reality of heroin is.
Yeah, because heroin itself, right, has moved into upscale, white, suburban neighborhoods, right?
Yeah. Actually, so Sam Quinones, I hope I'm saying his name right, he's the author of Dreamland, which is one of the resources that I used prepping for this podcast, this particular episode. I'm not quite done with Dreamland, so a true confession there, but it's a pretty hefty read. Anyway, he talks about heroin as being young, white, and middle to upper middle class. So it's young, white, relatively affluent people who are the face of the new heroin epidemic. Completely the opposite of what some people still think and what we've all kind of been led to think.
Right.
You know?
Do we have anything about why heroin has made such great inroads?
Oh, well, sure. I mean, that's what this whole podcast is really about, right?
Yeah, so here's the softball.
Yeah. So, you know, really kind of putting it in context, it seems like, and when you look at I don't really want to say the research, because I can't say I looked at hardcore research papers. I looked at some of the journalistic research, for lack of a better term, done by people like Sam Quinones, really talking about how this new heroin epidemic seems to have evolved somewhat side by side, but also in response to huge marketing of prescription painkiller drugs, specifically OxyContin.
Right. So, okay. So, is there a tie between, some kind of correlation between the increase in prescribing Oxy and general use of heroin?
So, what it really looks like is that the increase, especially in black tar heroin, which we'll get into the differences in terms of heroin here shortly, but it really looks like the increase in black tar heroin use is pretty directly linked to the rise of our use in this country of drugs like OxyContin, and then people getting cut off from their source, not being able to afford their source, for whatever reason, losing that ability to continue to get those prescription drugs. Black tar heroin is cheap. It's easily available. In many, many cases, it's a lot cheaper than prescription drugs and easier to get a hold of.
Yeah.
So that's what it really looks like. It's kind of interesting because I looked up a fair amount of information to go along with this, and the numbers are incredible. So OxyContin started to get heavily marketed in the early to mid 1990s. So just looking at the numbers, and this is from an article at the website for Frontline's documentary Chasing Heroin, which I highly recommend. It's about 2 hours long. If people don't want to commit to reading Dreamland, and if they don't want to commit a whole bunch of time to this topic, but they want to get a sense of what the new heroin epidemic looks like, I highly recommend the Frontline documentary. It's so good. But anyway, these numbers are from the website associated with that. In 1991, so before or right around the time the heavy marketing of OxyContin, 76 million prescriptions were written for prescription painkillers. Step it up to 2011, 219 million prescriptions written in 2011 for prescription painkillers. So nearly triple the number of prescriptions for painkillers or opiate medications. And it seems to be really, again, directly linked to the heavy marketing of OxyContin. What really happened, and this is so interesting, especially from the standpoint of someone who, you know, I started working as a nurse, not even a nurse practitioner, right around the time that OxyContin really started to become the drug of choice.
Sure.
And when I say the drug of choice, I mean the drug of choice for treatment of pain.
Prescription, yeah.
Right.
The drug you give people because they are legitimately
in pain.
Right.
And so, you know, all along we had been terrified of creating addiction. And so that was why opiates, prescription painkillers, were pretty much reserved for people with severe post-operative pain or terminal pain, like cancer pain.
Right. And the sad truth is that there's an ongoing evolution of pain drugs that are worse than the ones that they replace.
Sort of. I mean, and I think I've said this to you before. I don't know if I've said it on the podcast, but, you know, one of the things that I've walked away from, especially now seeing all of these heroin-addicted people in prison who also have hepatitis C, one of the things I've walked away with is that we actually have a pretty poor understanding, we as a society, of how to treat and deal with pain. But so we kind of went from everybody's going to be an addict, so only someone who is dying or who's had a limb cut off should get opiates. We kind of went from that to, oh, well, you know, people don't really get addicted and there's really a low chance of addiction, so it's okay.
Okay. And sorry.
I know, but, you know, it's actually Purdue Pharma, who is the pharmaceutical company that developed and marketed OxyContin. They're responsible for a lot of that.
Oh, sure.
So there was a letter, and I wish I could remember who wrote it, because it keys in pretty heavily into all of this, written to the Journal of the American Medical Association back in the early 90s. And it was just an observation that someone had written, you know, gosh, in what I'm seeing, only about 1% of the patients I'm dealing with get addicted. Well, this person was dealing with end-of-life care. So, you know, when you're looking at people who are dying, and you're looking at rates of addiction in people who are dying, it's very different from kind of the treatment of chronic pain that we see today, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I shouldn't laugh, but I mean, that is just, that on the face of it sounds like really really crappy correlation.
Well, because you understand science. I mean, it goes back to the understanding of science, right?
You know, if you prescribe painkillers and end of life in the, on the average, you know, hospice, right? What's the average life expectancy in a hospice?
Well, you're supposed to have a life expectancy of 6 months or less to be enrolled in a hospice program.
Right. At that point, A, addiction is meaningless, but right. B, you're not even going to be around long enough to become an addict.
Right. and again, I mean, the bottom line is addiction's meaningless. Who cares in yeah. that circumstance? But the thing that's even more salient about this letter is that it was a letter. It wasn't a research study. It wasn't a research study with huge numbers of subjects. It wasn't a research study that was duplicated in other settings. It was a freaking letter.
Which, and then of course, begs the question, was the letter even real?
Well, I believe actually the letter was real because the author of Dreamland goes into this in his book, and one of the people who authored the letter is pretty horrified that it got twisted the way that it did, because basically it started getting quoted again in large part due to Purdue Pharma as a study.
Wow.
And it started, you know, when they were sending reps out to market OxyContin, and when they were having, you know, drug manufacturer lunches to rep OxyContin, it all of a sudden became, well, author so-and-so in the JAMA issue, blah, 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 in the year, I forget, it was in the early 90s, says that only 1% of people who use opiates become addicts. And that was how it was presented to people who were getting their education about using this new medication from the pharmaceutical company, which, let's be honest, that still happens a lot. When I was in private practice, I met a fair number of drug reps, and they would come in and cite all of these studies and say, that's why this is a great drug. This is why Breo is a better drug than Advair or whatever, you know? So it doesn't happen in quite the same way because of laws that reduce our contact with pharmaceutical reps and reduce what we can accept in terms of gratuities from pharmaceutical companies, but it still happens that way quite a bit. So, you know, you're kind of depending on those people to give you good information, especially when you're in the middle of a busy clinical day and you don't have time to go read the studies. You're depending on them to give you good information. So anyway, bottom line is this letter got taken out of context, twisted into a big study and cited as a big study. And it actually, that's not what it was. But all of a sudden, Purdue Pharma and other manufacturers of opiate prescriptions started telling all of us healthcare providers, oh, well, you know, the risk of addiction is significantly lower than what you think it is. So, you know, a lot of us started to believe that. And they also, at the same time, talked about how we were under-treating all of this chronic pain. So it suddenly became not just you should be treating people with severe life-threatening injuries or illnesses and treating people who are in hospice, but you should be treating everybody with chronic pain with opiates.
Okay.
So, you know, which again, you know, that's super challenging. I have people in my life who deal with daily chronic pain. I have friends, I have family members, you know, I see people in the clinical setting who deal with a certain level of chronic pain every day. How do you treat that? I'm not sure we have a great idea. You know, Right. Now we're kind of swinging back to, well, you treat it with Tylenol and ibuprofen, and you realize that a certain amount of pain is part of the human condition.
Well, let me ask you something. Is there, with my understanding of most addictions, right, it's quantity over time.
Well, it certainly becomes one of those things where you need more drug to achieve the same effect. And that's not really addiction. That's physical dependence. That's right. Just kind of the mechanics of how it works. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that I think of addiction is, if you would sell your soul or someone else's to get your next hit of that drug.
Okay, right. That's where it's a problem.
You know?
Addiction is where it's a problem versus dependence, which is... just the operational side of it.
Exactly. Okay, so, I mean, there's a certain amount of physical tolerance that goes along with almost any drug.
All right, so... So I go out and I get myself racked up in an automobile accident tomorrow.
Sure. Not, but,
right? ER, a lot of pain. And, you know, should I just be like, fuck it, no way, don't give me any of that?
So, and you know, this is where I probably fall into the middle ground. So I think what you do is you treat severe acute pain with something like a narcotic, an opioid. And then as the person heals, because you're involving other therapies, you're doing things like physical therapy, you're doing things like massage or a TENS unit, which is basically disruption of the pain signal from your brain to your nerves. You know, you're doing various things in addition to medication to try to deal with that pain. You gradually taper down that person's use of medication, and then eventually you've got them on non-opiate prescriptions or non-opiate over-the-counter medications like Tylenol, like ibuprofen, like Aleve. Am I saying that every person who has chronic pain should not have a prescription for opiate prescriptions ever? No. I'm really glad I'm not the person who's having to make that decision anymore.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's one thing that I've walked away from private practice with is I'm really grateful that I'm not writing prescriptions for prescription painkillers anymore because it's just really hard. It's really challenging. I mean, I've had surgery. Would I have wanted Tylenol or ibuprofen after surgery? No. You know, because, I mean...
Kind of hurts.
It hurts. But I think that the other thing is we also have to differentiate between acute pain, chronic pain, and then psychological pain. Because there are an awful lot of people who are using drugs like oxycodone and heroin to treat psychological pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
But and it's incredibly challenging, and I don't know that we know how to sort through all of it. But I do know that the quote-unquote data that Purdue Pharma was using to promote OxyContin was to a certain degree false. You know, and they created a generation of prescribers who were far less cautious about addiction, and now it's really come back to bite us in the ass.
So false in as in fraudulent or false as in inaccurate?
Both. Purdue Pharma actually pled guilty in 2007 to misleading docs and other prescribers when they were marketing OxyContin. They had to settle for a little more than $6 million worth of, $600 million in fines. Because of their guilty plea in this case.
And this stuff's still on the market.
Okay. And it's still on the market. Now, an important number for people to look at is that between the introduction of OxyContin, which was about 95, 96, onto the market, when it was available on the market, to 2001, so we're talking 6 years before those executives settled that case against Purdue Pharma, they'd already made over $1 billion worth of profits on OxyContin sales. So when you're looking at $1 billion worth in profits, as opposed to in the space of a few years, as opposed to several years after that down the road, settling for $600 million in fines and still getting to sell your drug, you know, it's a trade-off. Seriously, though, I mean, for a lot of these pharmaceutical companies, it's like, well... You know, so how much do we stand to lose? Okay, it's a trade-off.
Sure. It's the Ford Motor Company Pinto.
Right. It is. Yeah, you're putting it in your mouth.
Yeah, they knew that the Pinto was a problem, but right. They, you know, figured out what it was going to cost to settle it versus recall it. And
it was cheaper to settle it and still sell it.
Yep.
Well, you know, and the other interesting thing is... so they settled, Purdue Pharma settled in 2007... In 2010, they released a harder to crush, harder to snort or inject version of OxyContin, and that's now what's marketed as OxyContin. So it's a slightly different formulation. But, you know, it's basically the same drug. It's just harder for people to use it illicitly. And a fine point for people who may not know, so OxyContin is the extended release. Oxycodone, which is in Percocet, which is also oxycodone by itself, that's the rapid release. So they're essentially the same drug. It's just that the molecule has been changed in OxyContin to be time released rather than quick release or immediate release.
So, but in terms of addiction and everything, is there any difference between the two formats?
That's a super good question, and I don't have an immediate answer to that. You know, when I'm thinking about addiction to opiate painkillers, prescription painkillers, I'm thinking about the whole broad spectrum ranging from Tylenol 3s to OxyContin.
Yeah.
Morphine.
God, it's in there for everything.
Yeah, I mean, basically anything that's kind of related to the opium poppy, to the morphine molecule, that's kind of what I'm thinking of when I think of addiction to prescription painkillers. So it's not just OxyContin, but the rise in heroin use or the response of a rise in heroin use seems to be directly related to OxyContin in that people very often will turn to heroin when they can't, when they lose their source of OxyContin, because again, it's cheaper and more accessible to them. So, you know, and just putting the epidemic into context again, so heroin and other opioids, so prescription pain meds and anything kind of related to heroin, it causes about 27,000 overdoses a year in the United States. 40% more deaths from overdose than car crashes. It has now taken over deaths from motor vehicle accidents, as there's a higher rate of people who die from overdose in this country.
It's interesting. I'm looking at the LA Times. They did an article not too long ago on OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
OxyContin and Purdue's response, right? And Purdue is saying that the claim was that OxyContin has a 12-hour dosing problem that put patients at risk. And then their response is fact. Nearly a decade ago, the FDA cited a lack of clinical evidence when it formally rejected the fundamental premise that patients receiving OxyContin at intervals more frequently than twice daily are at increased risk of side effects and serious adverse reactions.
Wow.
The interesting statement there, though, is a lack of clinical evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's that damn science thing again.
No. It's.
But they marketed it without clinical evidence.
Right. What they're saying is a lack of evidence of harm is the same as saying
that there's no harm and that there's efficacy.
Right. But you know, it's interesting, right? Because if you think about what they're basing it on, a lack of clinical evidence, but specifically it would be a lack of clinical evidence at that moment that, you know, and so would the FDA have different results today? You know, and everything. I mean, it's so hard with all of these drugs, because when they go on the market, we have rules and everything, and the FDA does the best it can and everything, but it's not until something's on the market for a long term
to see.
That you're going to see the side effects don't happen until the long term.
Well, and the other thing is, and you know, I said this before, to a certain degree, as prescribers, we are dependent on the drug companies to give us good information. Right. I mean, yes, it's ultimately our responsibility to follow that up with some reading and some self-education. But when you're initially being introduced to a medication, a lot of times it is in the middle of a busy day where you have a rep saying, well, this is the new version of blah, 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 and it works way better than such and so, so you should be prescribing it for your patients. Have I ever prescribed just based on that? No, but that's often how you get introduced to a new medication.
Right. Right.
I had a great instructor in school who said, never be the first person to prescribe a drug and never be the last person to prescribe a drug.
And yeah, you know, the thing, of course, is, right, it's not just medicine, right? That's a pretty standard risk mitigation strategy throughout the world.
Sure. Never be the first person to sell that car. Never be the last person to buy that car, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, but being in the middle in the bell curve doesn't
protect you from risk or
what it protects you from
or liability.
It protects you from lawsuits. It does not protect people from harm.
Right. I think that's a really appropriate way of looking at it.
You know, and I mean, it's unfortunate because there's a lot of just, this is the way our country in particular works because of our laws, legal system, litigation and malpractice and everything, but nobody loses their job for doing something that everybody else does.
Well, and here's the other thing as well. I mean, no one loses their job. Well, this is not true. I wish it was true. I wanted to say no one loses their job by acting out of good intentions. And I think really honestly that when we look at physicians and other prescribers who were prescribing medicines like OxyContin, when we look at pain clinics, when we look at people who are trying to treat chronic pain more effectively, we're looking at people by and large who have good intentions. I mean,
absolutely. I do not doubt that for a minute, because if I come in and freaking arm is hanging on by, you know,
threads,
you know, I believe that when you give me pain medicine to help me with that, you have my best interest in heart at that very moment, no doubt about it, you know. Or if I come in with chronic back pain, right? Because I mean, it's a huge problem for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
Chronic back pain and stuff. I don't for a minute believe that most physicians, nurse practitioners, or anybody else who has the ability to prescribe throughout the world, right? I don't believe that anybody prescribes this stuff, you know, deliberately to screw people up. Yeah.
There's a very small, no, I shouldn't say very small, I don't have the statistics, so I can't say exactly how many, but there, you know, there are some pain clinics that appear to be out in the public, basically as pill mills.
Oh, sure, and there was a big one.
You write a prescription, and, you know, you pay for 30 seconds of consultation with a doc, and he moves on to the next room and sees, like, 40 patients a day and makes a shit ton of money. There are definitely some clinics that are set up that way, but by and large, your average family practice prescriber who is saying, yeah, I know what having that kind of back pain is like, is not trying to hurt someone or addict someone.
Absolutely. And by the way, the pain clinics, and there was a huge one here in LA that got shut down just a few months ago. But those are criminal enterprises, and they're clearly criminal enterprises, and nobody who's going to those thinks that it's legit.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the way that those businesses are structured, absolutely, it doesn't look like anything other than greed and profit.
Right. So again, I'm discounting that from the equation, because most of us aren't going to that, because people going to that know what they're going to. Yeah.
So when you say, you know, when you say how we do it in the rest of the world or how we compare to the rest of the world, you've made a couple of references to that. I do want to bring that up because I think that these numbers are really important too. So the United States consumes approximately 83% of the world's oxycodone prescriptions. So remember, that's the immediate release molecule.
And Number one.
Approximately 99% of the world's hydrocodone, which is stuff like Vicodin, Narco, Lortab.
Go USA.
So, and we really do, when you look at the combined prescribing for prescription painkillers, I want to say we're right around 75 to 80% of the world's consumption.
Right, and then how much how much of the world's consumption of heroin do we have on top of that?
You know, again, I don't have the numbers for that, but when you think about, and Sam Canones describes it perfectly, he calls it the Trinity of American prosperity. So we have the perfect setup for heroin marketing. We've all got a phone in our pocket. Most of us have cars. Most of us have a private home or, you know, a private apartment, some sort of private dwelling in which we can consume and stash our heroin. So, and I thought that was a great description. He talks about how that really influences a different model of delivery, of marketing of heroin. So, you know, it makes sense that we in the U.S. would have the highest rate of consumption for heroin in the world as well.
Actually, it turns out we don't.
We don't? Really? So who does?
This is weird. Iran.
Well, do you think it's...
14. This is per capita. So, I mean, I wouldn't doubt for a minute that bulk we probably consume more than anybody else. But per capita?
Uh-huh.
Iran.
Do you think it's proximity?
I'm sure that's...
Because it's probably a heck of a lot easier to get opium from Afghanistan to Iran than it is for us to get opium or opium products.
I think it's actually proximity to it and then lack of other choices.
Ah, okay. Because we're taking up like 70-80%
of the meth may not. Yeah, crystal meth may not be a big, widely available thing in Iran.
Right. So, you know, I mean, a couple other things that I did want to say just to kind of set the stage for OxyContin and prescription drug abuse and the relationship between heroin. It's really interesting, but, you know, although it does cross all racial demographics, like we were talking about earlier, the epidemic is largely white, young, and middle class.
Right.
When deaths by heroin are compared to deaths by prescription opiates... Heroin is a younger person's drug, so the highest rate of death by prescription opiates seems to occur in the 45 to 54 set when they're looking at age groups.
Which makes sense.
And the largest number of heroin deaths happen in people between 25 and 34.
Sure, and that's going to reflect the reality of incomes.
Well,
and the fact is, the older you get, the easier it is to go to a physician.
I was just going to say, your exposure to physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, it's more common, too. I mean, you go to a healthcare provider more when you're in middle age than you do when you're a young person, generally speaking.
Right, and then of course, the biases and everything, you know, people don't look at, dear God, you know, those of us who are in that age group, right?
Right.
You know, who you know, have families, jobs.
Right.
Know,
we're a respectable, little more secure. We're, yeah. Yep, yep.
Respectable people. They don't look at us as addicts.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas, you know, everybody thinks that young kids are addicts, no matter what.
Right. Well, you know what I mean? The other thing is, just when you look at deaths that are in the media. So that I've often heard it said that people really started to be aware of heroin deaths when Philip Seymour Hoffman overdosed.
Right.
So compare his death to, say, Prince's death. So Philip Seymour Hoffman, younger, very successful, probably closer to your age or my age, but still younger than Prince.
Right.
He died of a heroin overdose. Prince died of a prescription drug overdose. You know, so it seems to hold true in what we're seeing in the media as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think, you know, there are a lot of people who say that Philip Seymour Hoffman is kind of the face of the new heroin epidemic. Young, white, successful, you know? So...
So it's interesting, yeah, because I'm looking at the NIH page right now, right?
Uh-huh.
Wow, heroin overdoses from 2001 through 2014.
Oh, yeah, skyrocketed.
Skyrocketed. It went up five times, right?
Yeah.
With a huge jump from men. Women have an increase, but not nearly the same level as males. And it's weird, right? Because it's got to be. It's got to be availability.
It's definitely availability. And here's... go ahead.
Because cocaine...
is dropping off.
It drops off from its high in 2006. It's still, you know, a decent number in 2006.
But it doesn't have nearly the distribution that heroin does.
Hmm. Not anymore, right? Because it's no longer, you know...
Well, and so...
cocaine cowboys are done.
Right. But the OxyContin addicts who can't get their OxyContin are now on every street corner.
Right. So, and then here's the number of deaths from prescription opiate pain relievers, right? And, yeah.
Well, so it was really interesting. I also looked at an article written for Huffington Post by a woman named Jill Berman, and this was published in 2014. And at that point, she cited a statistic that 4 out of every 5 people who recently started using heroin started using prescription opiates first.
That's the gateway, not marijuana.
Yeah, it's absolutely a gateway. No, it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
But here's the wrinkle. Here's what kind of happened in terms of changing the model of how heroin is distributed in this country. And this is what's so fascinating about the book Dreamland and the work that Sam Canone's published. And if people aren't interested in investing the time in reading Dreamland, in addition to the Frontline documentary, Chasing Heroin, which you can stream online or you can listen to the podcast, there's also just a very brief article that was written by Sam Canones in the New York Times, and it's called Serving All of Your Heroin Needs, and it was published a couple of years ago, right around the time that the book first came out. But what he figured out with his investigative journalism is that really there was one small community on the west coast of Mexico, and I'm probably going to say it horribly because I don't speak Spanish, but it's Jalisco... X-A-L-I-S-C-O. And it started out as really a sugarcane farming community. But here's the deal, and I didn't realize this because I always thought that the bulk of the world's heroin came from places like Afghanistan, right? The opium poppy grows really, really well in the mountainous region along the Pacific coast.
Yeah.
So a huge amount of heroin actually comes from Mexico, which I didn't really realize until I started learning more about it.
Right. Although as of 2014, Kyrgyzstan, Thailand, India, Iran, the Netherlands, surprisingly, Turkey, Albania, Tajikistan, Pakistan, Afghanistan, from 10 to 1 in producers.
But what I would like to know is, are they... So the other thing is we're talking about black tar heroin versus the white powder that we're all familiar with, right?
Okay.
So the heroin that's coming in from Mexico is, and I hate to demonize Mexicans, God knows what our political climate is like right now. I hate to demonize the country of Mexico, but it is the place where most of our black tar heroin is coming from.
Sure.
So it comes as a little gummy black kind of ball, resin, that you can smoke or you can cook and shoot up. And it's completely unlike the white powder that we all associate with heroin. It's actually 2 to 3 times more potent, and it's really cheap. And the way that these entrepreneurs, for lack of a better word, from Jalisco started to market it is, you know, initially they kind of followed the rest of the heroin trade from Mexico. They would come up, they would be in large centers of population where like LA, or places where there were large communities of migrant workers where they could hide, and they would kind of follow that distribution of heroin throughout the country. But these guys from Jalisco realized that, you know, again, talking about that holy trinity of phones, cars, and private rooms, they started marketing it kind of like a pizza delivery system. You could call one central number. They work 7A to 7P. And they have a fleet of drivers who drive around with basically tiny balloons filled with black tar heroin in their mouths. One of the guys that Sam Canones interviewed said that he can fit about 30 of those heroin balls in his mouth at one point in time. They drive around with those heroin balls and they meet people in specific coded spots that they're their telephone distributor will tell them to go to. They sell a few balls of heroin and go on. So basically it's like you can get your heroin need met anytime between 7A and 7P by just calling a single centralized number. And they're really low profile. I mean, the way that they do it is they drive old cars. They look kind of like the average day laborer who's hanging out in front of the True Value or the Home Depot who's trying to get some work. And their drivers are actually not drug users. They're paid $300 to $500 a week. They only stay in the U.S. for a little bit, and then they're kind of rotated out for a new driver. So they're really low profile, and they're harder to catch than your average heroin dealer. I mean, they got really, really good at it. And by revolutionizing the way that heroin was distributed, this particular community in Mexico made heroin much easier to get in the United States. It's really fascinating when you read about it. The other thing that they did is they got to the point where they didn't just follow the distribution of Mexican migrant labor in the U.S. They started finding communities that were outside of those hubs, especially outside of the heroin hub. You know, because you think about places like New York City and L.A. when you think about the heroin hub. They started going to kind of middle-class, middle-sized communities, and they would find a pain clinic, and they would kind of get someone from the pain clinic hooked into their system, and that person would become a person that would introduce them to new groups of addicts.
Sure, that makes sense.
And so, you know, they were able to penetrate places like Appalachia, places like Middle America, in a way that no other heroin distributors were able to do previously. They also avoid violence. You know, generally speaking, they're not into gang conflicts. Generally speaking, they don't carry weapons. They want to stay as low profile as possible.
Yeah, and that's smart.
Yeah, so I mean, that's part of the reason that we've seen the heroin epidemic grow in response to demand, basically. I mean, now we have this whole population of people who, for whatever reason, aren't getting their prescriptions, but all of a sudden that niche has been filled by really clever and subtle dealers of black tar heroin, which is cheap and potent.
Ugly.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny because I know I sound a little bit excited when I'm talking about it, and it's not like I'm ecstatic that there's this new heroin epidemic, but when you think about all of the stars that kind of aligned for this to happen...
Oh, sure.
It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. No, I mean, and there's some serious arguments to be made about all of this is the direct unintended consequences of our decades-old war on drugs.
Absolutely. I think that it's a consequence of our war on drugs and our desire to keep people dumb by telling them just to say no instead of educating them.
Oh my God, that has always been the dumbest thing in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, really, by saying, don't think about it, don't learn about it, just don't do it. And then by creating this situation where all of a sudden we weren't treating any pain to now we're treating everything under the sun with opiates, I mean, it's just that perfect constellation of circumstances. It's pretty fascinating. It's pretty horrifying. I mean, I've told you before, and I think I've said it on the podcast before, now, on a regular basis, I think, oh my God, I contributed to this. Unintentionally and with good intentions, actually, but, you know, there are times that I definitely wonder if in fact that I did contribute to someone's addiction.
Sure.
And that's pretty horrifying. It's pretty horrifying to think that you were a part of it, even unintentionally. I think I told you this story. I mean, this is a story from Chasing Heroin from that documentary, but they tell this amazing story of this woman who said she didn't feel alive or normal until her first dose of Vicodin. her physician prescribed it to her after she gave birth. And she didn't have surgery, she didn't have a C-section, she had a normal vaginal delivery, but she got Vicodin for pain after childbirth, and then within a very short time was getting Vicodin any way she could. She said initially she would lie to her physician and say, oh, you know, I've developed these horrible migraines, and her physician would prescribe. And then about 2 years into her addiction, her husband confronted her physician, and the physician cut her off completely, which then she started doing stuff like going to real estate open houses, making an excuse to use the bathroom, and then searching through people's cabinets.
Yeah.
For narcotics. And then when she couldn't get drugs that way, she turned to heroin. And I mean, this woman tells this very compelling story of how her addiction developed and continued. And I mean, I can see myself getting easily taken in by someone who's like, oh, I'm just having these horrible headaches and I need blah, blah, blah. You know,
well, yeah, because as human beings, we want to help people who are in pain.
Sure, it's absolutely easy to fall into that trap. It's absolutely easy.
But, you know, but here's the thing, right? Legitimately, they are in pain. You know, it might not be migraine headaches, but if they're not getting their drugs, they're in pain.
Well, and interestingly, for this woman to say she didn't feel like herself, she didn't feel normal until she started using, I mean, that really speaks to a tremendous amount of psychic pain. And when I say psychic, I mean emotional, psychological. You know, it speaks to a tremendous amount of pain that is non-physical.
Sure.
And then you're absolutely right. When someone has an addiction and they are no longer receiving the substance to which they're addicted, it definitely can be painful. I mean, I've seen people in drug withdrawal and it's incredibly painful. So it's fascinating, it's interesting, it's horrifying. I mean, we really did have the perfect storm here in America, and we're just starting to even recognize it now. We're not even remotely coming to grips with it. I'm for some reason compelled to make this one point for people who are listening. Not that I think that our crowd is filled with people who are detoxing from heroin or opiates or alcohol, but you can die from an alcohol withdrawal. You cannot die from a drug withdrawal. You're miserable as hell, but you don't die from drug withdrawals like you do from alcohol. So I would just say, if you're withdrawing from something, anything, please get help. Don't take this podcast as medical advice.
Oh my God. No. This is a somewhat academic with a little bit of professional
right
conversation.
I guess, do you want to talk any more about the history, or kind of the history of distribution? I mean, there's so much to be said. This is barely scraping the surface. But I also wanted to talk a little bit of kind of, now how do we deal with the mess that we've gotten ourselves into?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. And there's not going to be... The problem with American drug policies in general is that coming up with better ones has eluded us
right
for a long damn time. You know, I mean, because there's going to be some interesting things that come out over the next... Again, it's long term, right? But in Colorado, in Alaska, California...
Oh, you're talking about marijuana legalization.
Right. Will that have an impact on other drug usage?
Well, right. So I do want to say, first of all, that I'm not equating heroin use to marijuana use. I want to be really clear about that, and I don't think you are either. But there actually was a recent study that came out. I want to say, I don't know that it was by a government organization, I'm doubtful, but it was a study of people who are receiving Medicare benefits, and Medicare beneficiaries who live in states where medical marijuana is legal are actually using a significantly lesser number of prescription painkillers.
It's interesting, although so, there could be all kinds of statistical reasons at this moment.
Sure, that. I don't know how good the study is, and I don't know, you know, what kind of numbers they're looking at.
Because we could have a drop, off from people dying, and if that, you know.
Except there's never been a documented death by
no, I'm just, overdose. I'm just talking about if
maybe
if the if the population's getting smaller and you're not accounting for that, right? It's gonna look like it's, you know, anyway.
Again,
I love statistics, but I question all of them these days because it's so easy to draw correlations where none should be.
Exactly, and I do think that, you know, we can talk about some of these things, but it is important to recognize we haven't read the study. We don't know how well the study was designed. We don't know if it was replicated. I mean, all of those things are important when you're looking at scientific evidence.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, it seems like that's a reasonable argument that where medical marijuana or just marijuana, period, is legal, that you may, that you would see a decrease in other drug usage. It seems like it should work that way, but it doesn't mean that it does.
And I will tell you that when I wrote my thesis, which now, I mean, that information is easily 10 years old, even though the thesis isn't, because, you know, there's a time lag between information that's published and when that information was actually obtained. Anyway, when I was doing my thesis, there was some evidence that marijuana seems to effectively treat neuropathic pain, which is a type of pain that a lot of people suffer from, but it's not well treated by opiates.
Right.
So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how it evolves. I think you're right. And I think, you know, we're kind of at this place now where we have essentially two drug policies in this country. We have the abstinence policy, which is the just say no, the pull yourself up by your bootstraps, for the love of God, man, get a grip and policy.
And deny access to everything.
Right. So we have that.
It's prohibition. Yeah, right. We have prohibition
or we have harm reduction. And I have to tell you that I am definitely an advocate of harm reduction, which is doing stuff like having needle exchanges, making sure that people who have addictions to opiates, whether they're prescription or whether it's a drug like heroin, have access to Narcan, which is the reversal agent for opiates, because you want people to get reversed rather than die of an overdose. At least I do.
Yeah. No, and it's the whole thing, right, is that harm reduction is the acknowledgement that people are going to...
They're going to use anyway.
Right. They're going to use anyway. And there's nothing in my life or any, you know, that I've ever seen that would lead me to believe that, you know, it's possible for people, some people to, you know, never use. Right. It doesn't make any sense. Right. There's always a segment of the population who has problems with this stuff for whatever reason.
Well, you know, and another story from Chasing Heroin, this young man tells a very compelling story. He was a heroin addict. He became enrolled in a methadone program. So methadone is a drug that we do actually use to a certain degree for chronic pain in this country, but we also use it to treat opiate addiction. And the way that it works is you go to a methadone clinic, you get one dose of methadone a day, and you're witnessed taking that methadone. So, you know, there's theoretically very low risk of diversion, very low risk of illegal diversion of the drug that you're getting from your methadone program. This kid got into a methadone program, and he actually testified in a hearing in Bremerton about starting a methadone program. And he said, you know what? I didn't have it together when I was doing heroin. I was always chasing my fix, but now that I'm on methadone, I'm healthy, I have a job, I own my own house, I raised my child. You know, so he actually is a kind of a poster child for harm reduction. Yeah, he is still taking something that helps him function.
Yeah, he's still addicted to methadone.
He still has a physical addiction to a drug, but he's a productive member of society. And if that's what people's... You know, I don't know that that's necessarily always my measure of someone's value, but if that's someone's measure of value, if you're looking at the abstinence folks versus the harm reduction folks, this kid's a success story.
Right. Well, I mean, it does. There's an interesting question there, right? Which is, if heroin was legal, right?
Right,
could people control their addictions better?
Some harm reduction programs look at legalizing heroin.
Yeah.
I think it goes back to that there are some people who can walk away from a substance, and there are some people who are just horribly addicted, and we're not quite sure how that mechanism works.
Chemistry in the brain, right?
Right.
It's really always about chemistry in the brain.
Right. Oh, God. Science again.
So, just the reality of who we are, right? We are a bunch of complex freaking chemicals.
Right. And, held together by water.
Walking around in a meat sack.
Held together by water.
God, yeah.
So, you know, not to belabor things, because I know we're kind of coming up against time here, and we've got a few more things we want to talk about, but I did want to talk a little bit about the harm reduction program that they have in Seattle. So, and they talk about it quite a bit in Chasing Heroin. It's called the LEAD program, which stands for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. So instead of people who are contacted for heroin use, for example, instead of arresting them and putting them into the trial courts, they don't arrest them and they divert them to resources. So they divert them to housing resources, to treatment resources, to basically situations where they can get some help, but there are not legal charges brought against them. It's different from a drug court. So drug courts are, if you agree to go to drug court, you complete whatever mandated treatment there is, and then charges are dropped. In this case, they're actually shuttling you toward this program rather than putting charges against you. The places where people don't qualify for the LEAD program, which I think is appropriate, if it is a violent offense. So if there's a weapon involved in the drug offense, then it automatically is disqualified from the LEAD program. But if it's a non-violent drug offense, you are someone who qualifies for LEAD for the diversion program instead. And it's really interesting. There was an independent study done of this program in Seattle, and people who were diverted to assistance had a 24 to 58% lesser likelihood of reoffense, of committing another crime, when compared with people who were incarcerated and prosecuted for the same offense. So not only are you helping that person as an individual, but you are also making the public safer by decreasing the risk of reoffense.
Right. Seems like a good way to spend our money
as compared to just locking people up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It was really interesting. So again, referring back to that Frontline documentary, they talked with people who were participants in Seattle's LEAD program. They talked to people who were counselors. They talked to law enforcement officers who were involved in it. So you get a whole bunch of different perspectives. I think one of the things that's probably shocking to the abstinence people, to the, God, what did you call it? Not abstinence.
Prohibition.
Prohibition. To the prohibition folks, is that you can stay in LEAD even if you relapse. So somebody is not kicked out for repeat drug use, because they basically want to say to people, we're available to you, and when you are ready, further help is available to you, but let's at least make sure that you are safe, you have food, and you have a roof over your head.
Right.
Which again, you know, I think that's a humane response to a human condition. I mean, we see addiction to all sorts of things in all aspects of society, and this is the first place where I've really seen a humane response to someone who is still suffering from addiction.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to just also kind of bring up education as a part of harm reduction. I actually went to the website for King County. So kingcounty.gov actually has a bunch of different resources for people who are in the grips of addiction. And it's pretty amazing. It's stuff like what to do if you're in a situation where somebody overdoses. what to do if you get an abscess at an injection site, how to clean your needles, how to sterilize them if you are reusing needles. I mean, it's all sorts, and it's just amazing. It's all sorts of stuff that really seeks to make the person who is continuing to use safer and less likely to become a risk in terms of spreading disease, in terms of becoming a risk to all of us, in terms of, you know, getting hospitalized with this hugely expensive illness that we're all paying for.
Yeah.
You know, just for example, there's a condition called bacterial endocarditis that the bacteria that gets injected into someone's system when they're using drugs, that bacteria can actually settle on someone's heart valves and cause serious damage to the valves that help your heart operate. Sometimes people end up with valve replacements as a result of it. So we're talking about a huge, lengthy hospitalization. We're talking about tons of antibiotics, intervention by cardiologists. All of those things are tremendously expensive. If you're looking at someone who's living on the street and who is not making any money and most likely doesn't have health care or most likely has something like Medicaid, you're looking at a tremendous strain on the society's resources. So if you can prevent that by being humane, that's pretty huge.
Right.
So anyway, I was just impressed by the level of education at King County's website. And it is part of the harm reduction that they're trying to put into place. And Seattle is the forefront of that.
Yeah, Seattle's a good town.
Yeah, Seattle's got a lot of good things going for it. So, I feel like we've barely scratched the surface. There's so much more to say about drug use and heroin and opiates and prescription painkillers in general, but we've talked for a long time, or at least I've talked for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting, right? Because, you know, we've spent about $25 billion already this year on the drug war, right? We've arrested over 500,000 people for cannabis this year. Yeah.
So we're not even talking about something that poses a huge public health problem. Because right. Cannabis really doesn't.
And 89% of those cannabis arrests are going to be possession-only charges.
Right.
Right.
And then when you think about diverting, let's say, even half of that $25 billion to a program like LEAD, yeah, where you're making sure that, yeah, you know, you're kind of saying, okay, you're going to get clean on your time and you may never get clean. You're admitting that, but we're going to make sure you're healthy and safe in the meantime.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and the reason we have a problem with this in this country is because of our general bias against illicit drugs.
Well, and I'm going to...
The belief that people who use illicit drugs or use drugs illicitly...
that's probably a better way to say it.
Right, yeah. You know, again, it goes back to, you know, they're just skid row addicts, right? And nobody cares when, in fact, it's so not true.
Well, and I'm going to inflame things further and say that it goes back to the Puritans. You know, I mean, we are a puritanical society still. And we think that there's some kind of moral failing in someone who uses drugs. We think that there's some kind of spiritual void in someone who has an addiction. Now, I would say, yeah, I think there's probably some unaddressed emotional, and if you're a believer, spiritual stuff. But, you know, regardless...
Honestly, it's just a chemical problem in your brain.
Right, and regardless of things like that that can be addressed, you still need to recognize that there is, I agree with you, a certain percentage of people who are going to have serious problems with addiction, no matter what resources are available. And it doesn't have anything to do with whether or not you believe in God or, you know, whether or not you watch pornography or, you know, it has nothing to do with any of that shit. It just is chemistry.
Yeah.
But yeah, because we are a puritanical nation founded by and largely still run by Puritans, we think that the prohibition, the abstinence only. And when I say abstinence only, I'm not just talking about sex, but I'm also talking about drugs. We think that those people are the moral people.
Right. And then one of the biggest problems we have in this country is our drug education programs, right?
Which is nil.
Which is nil, or revolves around just say no.
I was going to say, it all still, I mean,
reefer madness, right?
Yeah.
Level of education, right? Like, you know, if you smoke weed, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and then it's so not true. And then if that's not true, what else isn't true, right?
Right.
You know, heroin is nasty ass shit.
Yeah, I'm not supporting heroin use, but I am saying, you know what? Number one, there are people who are going to do it no matter what. Number two, we've largely contributed to it in our mainstream medical system.
Right.
So we need to figure out a way to deal with it.
Yep.
And saying, just say don't do it, isn't enough.
Dear God.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I would just like to point out, again, not conflating marijuana use to heroin use, but Michael Phelps is now the most decorated Olympian ever, including breaking a 2,000-year-old record that was associated with when the Greeks first started hosting and recording the Olympics. And how long ago did he get busted for his bong hits?
Yeah.
I mean, come on, people.
Yep.
I don't know. The other thing that I would like to say, too, is that as a society, I think we really do need to get over our idea that we should experience no pain. I mean, yeah, it's nice to be not in pain. It's nice.
Wow. Okay.
It's nice to be pain free. But here's the truth. And, you know, the Buddhists say it best. There is a certain degree of pain that you get when you take human birth. And I'm not saying that people should be in uncontrolled pain or people should be in terrible psychic pain all of the time. But, you know, you gotta recognize that a certain number of the aches, pains, twinges, and heartbreaks that you have are just part of living in a human body. And we can't numb everything out. And we're not supposed to numb everything out. I lost you there, didn't I?
No, you're probably right. I'm just kind of thinking about it. You know, you're probably...
I mean, I think a lot of our addiction issues in this country come from our belief that we should be completely without pain. And that's just not the way that it works.
Nope. But on the other hand, who am I to stand in your way if you want to?
There's got to be a decent balance. You know, I mean, there has to be a reasonable way that we can treat incapacitating pain safely. But people also have to recognize that, you know, you can't avoid every ache, pain, twinge, and heartbreak in life. You just can't. And you shouldn't. I mean, to a certain degree, you grow from experiences that are painful.
Yeah, you're moralizing.
You're right, I am. But, you know, I also feel like the... And, you know, maybe this is my own internal guilt about contributing to the addiction problem in our country, but I do feel like there are an awful lot of people who think they should live an entire existence pain-free. And I don't think that's true.
Okay.
On that note... Is there anything else that we should say or that you want to say about our heroin, not just for hillbillies episode?
Well, we've been mightily unfair to hillbillies. So.
We have been. And actually, I do want to say that on a completely different note, there is a book out by J.D. Vance. I saw him speak on Fareed Zakaria's program this morning. It's called Hillbilly Elegy. And it's kind of talking about Appalachian culture and some of the really tragic things that are happening because of poverty in that area of the world. And it just made my Kindle pile, my virtual pile, a little bit higher. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we jokingly say heroin, not just for hillbillies anymore, but it's joking.
Yeah. Which was a play on the fact that Oxycontin
was called hillbilly heroin.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, you know, all in poor taste on our part.
Very much.
We admit it and apologize.
For the one person in Appalachia who's listening to this podcast.
Never know. Could be more than that. And they're like, fuck these guys.
Yeah, now we're never going to listen to you again, assholes.
Yep.
So on a completely different subject, do you have a fuck that guy? Do you have a Hall of Honorable Mention?
There is, as this political race continues on, there is nobody who gets an honorable mention anymore, in my opinion. Yeah. At least I haven't found anybody this week.
So I have an apolitical honorable mention, but I think I'm going to save that for last because it's a happy thing, or, well, sort of a happy thing.
Sure.
My fuck that guy goes to Katrina Pearson, who is a spokeswoman for the Trump campaign. Did you see her this week?
Yeah, but I mean, at a certain point.
I know. At a certain point, you just have to say, fuck all those guys, right?
Right. I mean, but I do want to... They're all the same. It's all the same nonsense, right? Because, yeah, she was Obama is responsible for Afghanistan.
Yes,
right?
She actually called it Obama's war. She credits him with getting us into the war in Afghanistan. And by my calculation, he was not president at that point in time. Was he even actually in the U.S. Senate? I think he might have still been a state senator when 9/11 happened.
Right.
But the thing that I wanted to bring up even more, which is just incredibly hilarious as a response to her, there's been a big Twitter hashtag called Katrina Pearson History, and here's some of the responses via Twitter. This is hilarious. Media currently reports Obama released the Black Plague in the 1300s to prepare for the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah. I have noticed that there has been a significant uptick, not just in the Twitter stuff, right, but like legitimate legitimate news organizations like the New York Times
and
the Washington Post.
They're trying to hold them a little more responsible.
Yeah, well, yeah. And they're basically, they've been doing some very Onion-like headlines lately, because it's gotten that absurd. You know, the whole Trump thing has gotten that absurd.
It has, but it's also nice, you know, not just Onion-like headlines, but actually real interviews. And again, I'm looking at mainstream media primarily when I say this, but they finally are starting to say, you know, Katrina Pearson, you can't get away with saying that because here are the real facts in the situation. So how do you respond to that? So I'm actually, it's quite late that the mainstream media has finally started to not give the Trump campaign a pass, but they finally are pushing back on some of the stuff that's blatantly false. And I'm glad to see that. But I just have to share a couple more of the things from Katrina Pearson history because they're so funny. Okay, this is from a guy named Bugatti Bob. Obama ordered Japan to be nuked, but then complained 2 days later he was only being sarcastic.
Yeah.
Obama made Hawkeye have a nervous breakdown and Father Mulcahy to lose his hearing. That was Obama's war. Obama didn't wash his hands after using the all-gender restroom, and he took a number two. There's just some really, really funny stuff. Some of it juvenile, some of it incredibly funny.
It would be so much funnier
if it wasn't based on something that was truly said.
Yeah. Yeah. But, so I know better. I've been looking at 538 every day.
So what's the update from 538 today?
Oh, it's ridiculous, right? Hillary Clinton, 88.8% likely to win this election. Donald Trump, 11.1% likely, right? And at this point, Arizona and Georgia are both blue.
Wow.
Not real blue, but...
Purpley blue.
No, more than purple.
Bluey purple?
They're very light blue, but they're definitely
blue.
Wow. So, yeah, I mean, it's just ridiculous, right?
Although, you know, all of those memes that are showing people holding up signs that say, this election is an insult to our intelligence, there's a part of me that agrees. There's a part of me that is yet again, like, really? This is our choice? Armageddon or tea?
Exactly, right? Gonna go with the tea, thanks.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, basically since August 5th, Clinton's chances of winning have been above 80%.
Wow.
So, I mean, while there's, you know, still a lot of noise in these things, definitely starting to see some stability in that regard, right? That, you know, for 10 days now, it's been over 80%.
Well, and I've got to say, I think it's because the Trump campaign is so tremendously off the rails, finally, that even people who are in the mainstream are like, this is crazy. You know, saying that Barack Obama is the founder of ISIS, saying that, you know, you can jokingly call for the assassination of the other candidate, that is so completely beyond the pale. Of course, you and I think that things like calling Mexicans rapists and criminals and saying that women would look really good on their knees giving a blowjob, or implying that they would look really good on their knees giving a blowjob, you and I think that's beyond the pale in political discussion. But it's taken calling for assassination of a candidate to get other people to that place.
Yeah. Wow, and if the election was held today, Hillary has a 92% chance of winning.
Wow.
It's just crazy. Oh, yeah, it's gotten to the point where Nate wrote an article the other day that was interesting. What a Clinton landslide would look like, right?
Nate and Silver, you owe us a plug.
Yeah. And what Nate was talking about is basically the point at which the popular vote, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's she gets plus 3% of the popular vote, North Carolina is 0.7 above, you know, over dipshit. And Arizona is 7.1, Georgia is 7.2, which is how those are, you know, looking blue already.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, you know, it gets up to where Mississippi... If she wins the popular vote by 12%, it's likely to get her Mississippi. 13% will get her Indiana and Texas. Montana, wow. Montana, Utah, South Dakota are all in the 14 range. Kansas, Alaska, and Nebraska are in the 15%.
Sorry, Alaska. What can I say? Thank you, lucky stars. We only have 3 electoral college votes.
No, I mean, I think it's okay, you know. And Alaska is who they are, but I mean, I think there's a high chance that they might turn out in a big way for Gary Johnson.
Yeah, we talked about this on our last episode, and I think you're right. I mean, I think that it's going to be a clusterfuck of write-ins and third-party candidates.
Right.
So
now, if Clinton wins by 16 points in the popular vote. She's going to carry everything except Idaho. The hell? Looking at this wrong. Try this again. My website is having a problem. Anyway, if she carries it by 16 and the popular vote, she's going to get 471 of the electoral college votes to Donald Trump's.
And there are 535, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. This can be a complete and total blowout.
Although there is still that large percentage of people who push back against all of this and defend Trump. I mean, I don't know that I believe it's going to be a blowout. I think at this point, I agree with Nate. She's highly likely to be the next president, but I think there's going to be that core of people who have been brought forth and unearthed by the Trump campaign.
Yeah, but again, first of all,
that core has always existed.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean,
it's just
thing
okay. It's acceptable to be part of that core now.
I mean, Clinton is now 49% of the popular vote. To Trump's 41%. I mean, I've never said that Trump is not going to get votes. He's going to get a lot of votes.
Yeah.
It's just going to be meaningless. Yeah.
Meaningless in the election. Meaningful in that we have a shit ton of work to do in this country after this election is over.
Well, we always do after every election, and it seems like we still can't do any of
that. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. it's really going to come down to the Senate seats and therefore the Supreme Court nominations and so on and so forth.
Well, I thought it was interesting that Mitch McConnell came out this week and said there's a high likelihood that he will not hang on to his own seat.
Well, that's interesting.
And, I, you know, certainly some of it is a red flag to Republicans saying, come on, people, get it together. We've got to think about those down ballot races, and we've got to think about the face that we're putting forward to the country. But I also think it's highly instructive that he's worried.
Right. Right. And good.
Yeah. Maybe we'll get somewhere.
Right. You know. Let's see. Predictions for 2016 Senate seats.
Is this also 538?
No, it's not. 538's not running it yet. Well, wait a second. Maybe I'm wrong. No, they're not running. They're not running polls yet, but let's see. I don't know. Not seeing anything yet that's meaningful, but. We'll know. We'll get close as we get closer. It'll become more apparent.
Yeah,
what's gonna happen there? Yeah. So, yeah, Trump. Hey, keep doing what you're doing, man. It's working for you, man.
So I have to say,
you're winning.
I don't know if you saw the post that I shared, but our friend Lev posted a thing on his Facebook page that said Hillary Clinton is employing the art of war strategy, which is standing back quietly watching your opponent feed his dick into a wood chipper.
Yeah, which is true, and it's been that way.
And continue to be quiet.
Yeah.
As we said earlier this week, continue to be quiet.
Yeah, because after the short circuit thing, she shouldn't be allowed to speak.
So I have a completely not Trump-related Hall of Honorable mention.
Okay.
And I posted this link to our Facebook page earlier today. So I heard about this guy named Masood Hassani. I hope I'm saying his name properly. He's an Afghani artist. I heard about him also on Fareed Zakaria's show today, which, by the way, is a really sucky show. But there were a couple of good outcomes to that book and this. So I'm grateful for that. This guy started a Kickstarter for the Mine Kafan drone. And basically what it is, it's a drone that he's created that can go around and map where unexploded landmines are. And then it goes back and can place a little detonator in the areas directly over these landmines and explode the landmines without a human or an animal getting harmed. And the drone is far enough away when the landmines go off that it doesn't get destroyed either. It's super cool. And he figures in 10 years, this project can pretty much clear the world of unexploded landmines.
That would be cool.
So I gave to it today in honor of the podcast. I'd like to encourage our listeners to take a look, and if they are so motivated to donate to this project. It does look like it's been fully funded, so now everything else is just icing. But it's pretty cool. You know, the World Health Organization estimates that 10 people per day are either killed or maimed by unexploded landmines.
Oh, yeah. People have no idea how bad the landmine problem is.
And it's like 89 countries and territories around the world are affected by unexploded landmines. Yep, so this guy could make a giant difference.
And unfortunately, the United States has been one of the biggest contributors to the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we have yet to sign on to any of the international treaties related to banning landmines or anything like that.
So here we've got a guy who's a freaking artist and an entrepreneur in this country that we literally have bombed back to the Stone Age. Not that it wasn't in the Stone Age before, who now has come up with a relatively inexpensive solution for the world's landmine problem.
Right.
And so I say Hall of Honorable Mention to Masoud Hassani and his Mine Kafan drone Kickstarter. And please look for it on our Facebook page, because I really would like to get this up and running and functioning. It's super cool.
Absolutely. Let's do something good, right?
Yeah, no kidding. That's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, what? This is something that's completely not related to our current political climate. It's something that is going to help a tremendous number of people. That's amazing.
Yep.
So, and in keeping with the not Trump, not political theme, I picked a really frivolous Neil Gaiman quote to go out on.
Oh, good.
So this is from his Twitter feed in 2009. He says, "Off to bed. If squirrels take over in the night, I, for one, welcome our new bushy-tailed scampering overlords. And I know where the nuts are."
Well, that... There you go. That's a good... That is a good quote.
That just made me happy, and it made me think, oh, I need to get on Twitter, if nothing else, to follow Neil Gaiman's Twitter feed.
Yeah. Probably should be doing that myself.
Yeah. Yep. So, oh my gosh, this was a long and complicated episode, but I really appreciate people sticking with us.
Yep.
And I guess we'll talk in about a week.
Yay.
All right. Take care.
All right. Everybody have a good week.
Yep. Please do. And stay away from heroin, man.
Exactly. The girl pleads. The woman needs a wedding ring.